much you department. Melo, they just go. We'll
This is technically a responsibility of the Department of Rural Development and the Office of the Chief Justice. We are in engagement with them, but I think the question should rather be directed at them. But the rest of the issues my colleagues will deal with, I think we will start with the IJS matters first.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, I'm putting the microphone in front of me, so
For the purpose of recording, you have to speak on the microphone. Go to where the microphone is.
Thank you very much, once again, Honourable Chair. My name is Godfrey Seba. I'm the chairperson of the IJS board. I'm going to briefly respond to the IJS questions, and I think Honourable Horn's question was to say, are we seeing the tangible results as a result of the investment on the IJS program? In the presentation, Madam Ntsasa, Phalela Ntsasa, indicated that the cases that have been processed using the integrated justice system, in particular the case management system, were sitting at 595,481 by the end of the previous financial year, which is the period under review. At this stage, by the end of September, that number had grown to 836,231, which is a positive movement that shows that the systems, the case management systems that we have invested on, we're really seeing the results. You would recall that when we started this journey of integrating the case management system across Department of Police, South African Police Services, the National Prosecuting Authority, as well as the Department of Justice, we started expanding the footprint from a zero base to about 99 police stations a few years back to linked to about 20 courts. I'm happy to announce that, or to report, as we previously did, that that footprint has now been expanded from that number to about all police stations that we have in the country, which is the police sites, including the investigative units and all of that. That number has expanded to 1,144 police sites, linked to about 470 courts, servicing, of course, both the NPA as well as the Department of Justice in the lower courts. So that shows that we have done a significant amount of work. I've also indicated in the past in this forum that in order for the integration to happen, there's a number of prerequisites that needs to be put in place. In other words, each department needs to enhance their own systems to a point of integration. And there's work that needs to be done as well on the IJS transversal hub to make sure that those communication messages can move from one point to the other. In the previous reporting period, we've indicated that there's two departments that are still behind in terms of making sure that the integration endpoints are created to enable this integration to happen. Department of Social Development in particular, as well as Department of Correctional Services, were one of the few departments that were still lacking behind. At this stage, I'm happy to also indicate that we have established the prerequisites of endpoint integration for the Department of Correctional Services, as well as the Department of Social Development. Let me start with Department of Correctional Services. Department of Correctional Services, as you would know, the system that had been earmarked to participate in the IJS, as far as case management integration is concerned, is what you call the integrated inmate management system, whereby which has been deployed to Hosi Mampuru Correctional Facility in Pretoria as the first site, And we have also developed a new integration in that space, which we call the J7 integration, which is the warrant of detention, which can now move electronically from the Department of Justice to Department of Correctional Services. So in other words, when somebody has been incarcerated by the courts, the information that then flows to Correctional Services in the facility that has been enabled, and that information can move electronically. And of course, as the footprint of deployment in the correctional facilities, as the IMSS project progresses, that will also be expanded accordingly. As far as Department of Social Development is concerned, we have done one of the greatest innovations that we are very proud of, which is putting in place the probation case management system on mobile. So we have created a mobile application which can be used by social workers across the country to assess the children that are in conflict with the law. As you would know, the unique complexity about the Department of Social Development is that it's a department that has the provincial competencies. So in other words, all the social workers across different provinces are sitting in different domains. So in order for us to be able to integrate a department like that, it means we had to invest heavily on the infrastructure and make sure that all those provincial departments are integrating. So to deal with that, because that would have called for heavy infrastructure investment, which we didn't have money for, so we decided to develop a mobile application that links all the social workers across the country to the national department for those integrations to happen. So in other words, all social workers, the capability that we have built enables all social workers across the country to be able to access the information about that specific child from a national database. And this helps us to not do interventions that have already been tried and failed on children. So it's one of the key things that we have developed at this stage, and three provinces have taken that on board at the moment. Northwest Province, Limpopo, and currently the Eastern Cape is also coming on board. So what we have done, because of the limited resources, we have built the application as a proof of concept, and then engage with the different provinces for them to invest on the mobile devices themselves. And if you look at the cost of each mobile device, and the application itself can run on a tablet that could be purchased for as little as 1,600 rand, as opposed to making sure that all social workers across the country have computers or laptops that we could spend in the region of between 12,000 and as much as 25,000 rand. So I think that is one of the great things that we have done. However, with all the achievements that we have done, there is also a lot of challenges that we are continuously trying to resolve. We are doing fairly well on two of the three key priorities. We had five key priorities that we are delivering in three work packages, which is person management, case management, as well as business intelligence, which is basically how we measure in the performance of the criminal justice system end to end. In the business intelligence, we are doing very well, as Lebo indicated, that we are now have gone past the halfway of making sure that we can report on the key performance indicators that were approved by Cabinet a while back. I think we are now sitting at 18 key performance indicators out of the 28. So there's only 10 left that we still need to instrument and make sure that we can report. So that's one area that we are doing fairly well. The case management integrations have indicated we are doing well. Where we are not doing so well is on the person management integration. The person management integration is one of the biggest challenges that we have, because it's more complex than others. Of course, as far as the person identification and verification application, we have managed to put a system in place as the first phase to make sure that we can send the information to Home Affairs of the people that we want to verify their identities, and we get the response in real time. So that's what is in place. What is not in place is the unique person identifier, as well as making sure that we can track the persons electronically throughout the criminal justice system. The reason for the delay is that that calls for a lot of investment in the police environment. In other words, all case-related information systems within the police first need to be integrated for us to be able to create that unique key that we can link all the cases, all the evidence, all the photographs related to that particular person in the criminal justice system, so that we can be able to track that person throughout the system, so that we will know when the person gets arrested in a different jurisdiction, that is the same person that was arrested in the previous day in a different jurisdiction. So that we can empower our prosecution to be able to better oppose bail applications in our courts. So one of the key things that we have started getting closer to in resolving the case management system is making sure that we start the process of enhancing what we call the harness system within Home Affairs, which will enable us to get to the second part of the person strategy, which is identification of people that we don't know. If we pick up the fingerprints of the person in the crime scene, at the moment it's very difficult to identify who that person is. But now, with the commencement of the harness upgrade, Home Affairs will be making sure that all 10 fingerprints are identifiable in the system, and through the transversal hub, the police can go through the system and identify who that person is. So there's two key pieces of the puzzle that are critical in making sure that we can progress well as far as the person management process is concerned. First is the police integration of their own internal systems. Secondly is the Department of Home Affairs implementing what we call the new harness upgrade, putting in a new FS system, and also expanding the pool of the people that we are taking fingerprints from just citizens to include your visitors, your asylum seekers, travelers, and all those people, so that irrespective of whether a person is a national or a non-national, if we happen to find their biometrics on the scene, we can be able to verify that information with Home Affairs and know exactly who we have to look for. So those are the key things that we're still grappling to progress on. But as far as case management and business integrations, I think we are doing fairly well. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Mutapo.
Thank you, Chairperson. The presenter made mention of 18 KPIs. What are they? And what about the OCJ integration, Chairperson? Thank you.
And then maybe also to indicate that what you could probably look at moving forward is how to assist with location when a matter is reported. Because you know what people complain about is that when you call, sometimes 10-111, for them to understand exactly where you are is a challenge. Yeah, and you know, sometimes you know how to send somebody a location. Would you come up with a system that could assist the person that's trying to report the crime to send to 10-111 location where they are? Because it can actually help to eliminate a lot of crime. I'm worried when you're actually saying that the current system of Home Affairs cannot positively identify fingerprints. Is the system that we had all this time with Home Affairs not managing to have fingerprints? Because you know, fingerprints was something that was basic in terms of providing people with IDs. And also the purpose was to actually ensure that once you've got your fingerprint, then you will know who you are. Okay.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. The key performance indicators the full list is about 28 key performance indicators, which are basically the headline measures that Cabinet has approved as the measures that can be used to measure the criminal justice system end to end. It's a number of them with the list we can make available. I won't be able to call them just like this, but basically they cover all the process that the criminal justice process does, from the investigation, in fact, from the response of the police when somebody picks up a phone and call 10111. We measure the time when that call was made to the time when a vehicle dispatched arrives at the scene. So we aggregate those numbers per province, per magisterial district, and so on and so on. We also cover things that happen in the pre-investigation or in the investigation, in pre-trial, and so on and so on. So there's a number of these key performance indicators that requires enhancements of different systems within the criminal justice system. And it means that we're using a number of systems to tie the dots in order for us to be able to provide that. So it's a wide range of all of those key performance indicators that we can provide. As far as the OCJ is concerned, Honorable Chair, OCJ is one of those areas that are fairly grey at this stage. And that I can confirm that the OCJ itself is already part of the IJS board. They have a representation in the IJS board. However, we will be guided by how the transition will unfold in terms of what specific processes, what systems we will keep within the Department of Justice, which ones would be taken over by the OCJ as and when it becomes clear when the transition of the lower courts would move to the OCJ, and so on and so on. But at this stage, we still don't have an integration there, because there's a lot of work that still needs to be done to unpack what form the OCJ will take as part of the process. We take on board, of course, the suggestion that we crystallize, perhaps using the GPS systems, the location of people that reports the crimes is one of the things that we will look at, of course. And of course, there's a number of other initiatives that we have already started investigating, such as creating mobile apps for people to report crime and so on and so on. And then one of the great ones that we'll soon be able to report on is the court scheduler, which will be an application, a mobile app that links everyone who's involved in a specific matter, whether it's a witness, whether it's a prosecutor, and all of those people are complainants, so that people always know what happened in court if they were not required to be in court on a specific date, where the court is scheduled, if there's a postponement, when is the next date, and so on and so on. So those are the things that we are investigating to make sure that we can enhance and change the criminal justice system in the interest of our people. I don't know if there's any other question that I think I've covered all of them, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You can proceed. Department of Justice.
Chair, on the question of the case backlogs, the figure has been going up and now is coming down. There are virtually two reasons why that has happened. The first reason is, yes, there was a change in rules. So what we actually did with the rules was that the first appearance date was then captured once, and even if a matter after first appearance is moved to another court, a decision was made that first appearance still stays, because to a person on the street, it doesn't matter, you know, whether a first appearance was a first appearance. So that immediately then made the figures go up, because then we were reporting higher backlog. So yes, that was the first reason. But the second reason, probably at the same time was that the integration on the IGS transversal was taking place. Like I already indicated, the capturing of the cases is no longer done in our courts, it's done in SEPs and the information is transferred. There was change management issues around that. For example, some courts were linked with the wrong police stations as a result of the, what you call the redemarcation program. So there were some implementation issues here and there that left some of the cases not updated on the system. So the number as a result was higher than usual. But we have been working since then to stabilize things, to make things work better, to ensure that everybody updates and everybody receives the right messages. So that is why now the number has come down. So those are the two reasons. So going forward, you will notice that the number would more or less be right because all those issues have now been addressed. Thank you. Oh, then the other issue about case reporting. In the past, in the annual reports, we used to include a lot of case information. But since OCJ has now come into being, all the information about case finalizations now reside with the OCJ. The NPA, on the other hand, talk about case outcomes, and they're coming later in the day to talk about that. But everything that report that talks about case finalization, etc., that now resides with the OCJ, and those questions should be then asked from the OCJ. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I'll try and deal with much of the issues that relate to court services and the ones where we do not have answers. We'll try and provide those written answers by consulting with the DDG and the DG himself. I think first on the stats, as I think my colleague Lebo mentioned, it's very clear that the committee would like to get a better understanding of, you know, the disposal rates, you know, if I might use an example like that, of the courts, how the courts are performing, how long do cases take, what are the outcomes. So we'll work together with OCJ and NPA so that we're able to give you a sense of, you know, the performance of the courts with the different levels of the courts, with the High Court, the Regional Court, and the District Court. So we'll have discussions with the OCJ around those sort of things because they are very concerned that, you know, that's the area of responsibility. But we do understand that government would like to get a sense so that the citizens are comfortable in terms of, you know, how the courts are performing. We'd look at working together with them of various models. We do have data. It's really just to, you know, package it in such a way that we're able to report on that. On sexual offences, the question that was raised, in the current financial year, we have 17 sites that we are planning to modify. I need to mention that, Chairperson, that the report that we're giving you on sexual offences on the target, it's actually what is in the APP. But the regions, for example, the targets which are in the APP are projects that are managed at national level. But within each region, we expect all the regions to actually continue to add more. So it's not like every year when we say 14, that's 14 that we have done, because we will not finish if we were to do that. So these are actually the sites where there was a project called MATO, where we actually, you know, developed a blueprint of exactly what these sexual offences courts should look like. Those are mostly your main seats, but you're at your second level. You then have the regions taking over, where they actually have to implement the same. So if you were to look at the number, if you were to bring you the number for the regions as well, you'd actually then see that you're actually doing a little bit more. It's just that for purposes of the reporting, we're only reporting on the sexual offences which are on the APP.
With regards to the NRSO, which is closely related to the sexual offences, is it functional? Chairperson, we have a registrar, a director who is heading the NRSO. We have not yet finalised the functional structure to support the director, but there were contract people that were appointed to assist the registrar in terms of the capturing of the data. These were people both at national but also at regional level. And I need to mention to the committee that this work is done very much closely or collaboratively between national office and the regional offices through the director's legal. For example, in terms of data verification, the data capturing, this is done at the court level. Then it moves to the regional office, wherein it is our expectation that there would be a sort of a cleanup to check whether, for example, the status of the victim, whether it was a minor person or a person with a mental disability, so that we do not end up registering incorrect people at the national level. So we're busy with that process, both the national office, the registrar, together with the director, to do the cleanup. And this actually addresses the question on the audit qualification as well, Chairperson, because you recall that we audited and our data was found to be not particularly valid. So we're in the process of doing up the cleanup, but also ensuring that we create the capacity for the NRSO, especially to be able to issue the clearance certificates, because we've not yet been able to issue the clearance certificate, largely because of capacity, but also because of systems that we need to develop between ourselves and correctional services, or rather at the police. We started that process, and we hope that probably by the end of the end of the current financial year, we should be in a position to issue clearance certificates. The other issues raised by Chairperson relates to multilingualism. I'm sure, Chair, you will agree with me that this is a very contested terrain. The CJ has pronounced himself in terms of how he'd like to see this matter. But the matter, the Minister is also dealing with the matter in terms of the policy. One of the KPIs that we have a policy around this matter that we hope that by the end of the current financial year, in terms of, a language of court record. We have a policy that the minister is looking into that, so that by the end of the year we are able to then come out very clearly as a department in terms of what should happen, taking into account that the constitution provides for 11 official languages, and that this is one of the key drivers of the transformation of the justice system. And so at the appropriate time, Chair, we will come back and report, but it will also provide written feedback in terms of the status of the policy in respect of the use of multilingualism in the various courts. There are issues around, for example, I think the other one that's related to this would be the Official Languages Act. We already have ideas where we've gone and looked at the report of Stats SA on the demographics to see the dominance of the various language group. I think it's part of what the Honourable had suggested, that can we look at, for example, in Limpopo, what are the dominant languages, so that, we don't provide for maybe all the 11, but we can say we know in Limpopo based on the census report, because it's a reliable report, so we'll try and use that to assist us to actually move the thing forward. We'll go into KZN, we can actually see, what is the dominant languages in those areas, Northwest and so forth. We already have that data. So these are matters that are before the minister that must then give us guidance in terms of, how we're going to move forward with respect to the use of multilingualism. Chair, you'll also be aware that previously we had a project that we called the Indigenous Languages Project, which was where we were piloting with the use of the different ethnic languages in the various district courts. For example, in Northwest, in Luhurusi, we piloted on that. So there were various sites where all the people were using Setswana, you know, to actually do the proceedings of the court. We ran into a number of problems where, you know, some of the legal professionals says, look, although I'm Tswana speaking, I'm not really comfortable maybe to run the court proceedings, the technical aspects of the court proceedings in Setswana. So what you really need for that project to actually become successful is that your magistrate must be fluent and comfortable in the language, your prosecutor as well, and obviously your accused, your witnesses. In some areas we achieve a success, but as soon as either the magistrate or the prosecutor moved, we then had the project collapsing. But it's a very important project that we will go back in terms of the issue around multilingualism, so that we are in compliance with the constitution. In respect of the victims, I think we reported here on the victims survey. We are looking at working together with Stats SA, so that whatever we are doing works with Stats SA. Probably, maybe we should even on the survey. Maybe rather let Stats SA, because they have the capacity to actually conduct better research than us, to be the ones that actually do this research on us, for us in the courts. The minister has said that part of his policy trajectory is that he would like to bring the victims of crime to the center, so that you know, we are not seen to be only being focused on the accused persons, and not doing and not doing much for the victims. So part of doing the victim satisfaction survey, we started only with the victims for sexual offences to find out, you know, when they go to court, how do they experience the court, how are they being treated, what facilities are they being given. But we'd like to actually go beyond the victims of sexual offences to look at all victims of crime, because these are people that have been wronged, they've been hurt, and they shouldn't feel that when they go to the courts, they actually suffer what is called, secondary victimization. I'd also further like to talk to the issue on the Magistrates Commission. Chairperson will take up the matter with the Secretary of the Magistrates Commission. That area of work falls under court services, so that we can include in our report and probably even have a KPI in respect of the work of the Magistrates Commission, so that their work is not only restricted to what you call disciplinary matters, you know, like, for example, I would imagine you'd be interested in terms of the number of magistrates in terms of race and gender that are appointed, the appointment process, how long it takes, the vacancies which are there. And I can say that, Chairperson, part of the delays in the filling of the post is that the Commission has taken an approach where they've centralized the recruitment process. So all their recruitment for magistrates are actually taking place in one area. And although there are benefits to that in terms of consistency, but you also have attendant delays that come about, because then you have to do all the recruitment processes, within the country. To get towards the end, Chairperson, on the policy matters, I would request your indulgence that we defer this matter and give you written answers in respect of matters like your judicial governance and court administration model. I think you correctly mentioned that there are teams that have been set up, led by the DG, one of them, and the other one led by the Deputy President. I am not part of that process, and therefore I do not have the details of what is going on there, but we will request when we go back to National Office that we provide you with the full details in respect of mostly those policy issues, even the one around the outcome of the assessment that was done on the high courts, the constitutional court. What value did we get, what outcomes did we get on the Legal Practice Act, what is the progress in terms of the establishment of the forum, and so on. To get back to the small claims court, Chairperson, indeed we've achieved a lot there. We've almost concluded the process to establish the small claims courts in all the districts. But one of the main issues, I think, Chair, that you were trying to raise in respect of the sheriffs is actually the costs more than the location. All the sheriffs are located in and around the court. There's very few of them. We've had a few of them that were a little bit far away from the court, maybe in another district acting, and we told them they need to set up an office in a district where they are working so that they don't charge the litigants the cost of from actually where they are actually staying far away from the court. So if you are appointed for two districts, matters for you must actually have two offices. You must have an office in each district. Or if you don't, you must charge the people that for whose court processes you are serving. You must charge them from the district where the matter emanated, and not from an office where you are working, because then that is the to the advantage of the people. So we are in discussion with the guidance of the Deputy Minister. He's also concerned about this, that the poor people who go to the small claims court and they have process to be served and they're chasing R1,000, that money might end up just being used by the cost of the sheriffs. And so it's something that we're looking at, and once we get guidance, we might want to start the process for amendments to actually make it easier. For example, we might even consider, if possible, using some of the or giving powers to some of the court officials to serve that process, or maybe consider the police to serve that process. But these are matters that we're still under discussion, so that we can then ease, you know, the cost on people that are going to the small claims court. A training of the clerks and the commissioners also is ongoing, so that we have people that can comfortably work in that area. In respect of maintenance, Chairperson, on the defaulters, our chief director, Advocate Kambula, and vulnerable groups is working on the defaulter strategy. But the committee will be aware that already there have been various amendments to actually make it easier to track, but also to get interim relief so that you don't have to wait until the matter is finalized before you get your money. You can, at first instance, when you do the application, request the court that the children must eat whilst this matter is going on. So you'd want to get a sort of interim relief so that money is then dispersed. And we believe that when that happens, that will force the respondents to actually come to the party and settle as quickly as possible, because the matter that the court, the amount of money that the court might determine as the quantum might be actually a little bit more. And so we'd like to thank the assistance of the Portfolio Committee in assisting us in effecting those amendments. The aspects of the quantum, Chairperson, as you're aware, it's really based on the means test, according to the earning capacity of each parent. But what is emerging in terms of the discomfort that a lot of women are experiencing on this is that it doesn't look like the court listened to what they are saying. And so part of what the minister has started discussing with the chief magistrates is that perhaps we should start moving the maintenance hearings into the public domain, into the court itself, rather than hearing these matters in chambers. Because often women complain that, I came, I saw the magistrate discussing with the defense attorney and with the maintenance officer, my story was not really looked into. And then I have an offer that I completely feel that is unjustified. So we've also taken up this matter. We would like to have these matters heard in public, so that there is no suspicion that there is anything untoward that could be taking place. With respect to the Board of Sheriffs, Chairperson, we work very closely with the board. We've got representation in there. We get their annual reports. We would be happy to actually either present their report or request the committee to ask them to be part of us when we report. But we have a very close working relationship. We believe that the modern sheriff has kind of changed from the old sheriff that used to break doors and that would not be stopped by the dogs. So we have a modern sheriff where there are even a lot of women that have been appointed as sheriffs. Yeah, I think, Chairperson, I've tried to cover as many aspects as possible. If I've committed any one, my colleagues would assist me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think the issue of the sheriffs, you need to actually have a report on location of those offices. Because what people are complaining of is when the office of the sheriff is in an industrial area where the taxis don't go and the buses and the train don't go. So who is it established for? So what I think we should actually do is to just make a study of the sheriff, the location of offices of the sheriff, so that when we say we think it's fine, it's based on information, because we continue to get complaints about such locations. And remember, with small claims courts, the complainant must actually be the one that takes these documents to the, not only to the sheriff, to the defendant. They must they must go in and serve him with a subpoena themselves. They must then take the documents to the sheriff's office of the sheriff. But then if that office of the sheriff is inaccessible, it becomes a cumbersome process. You know, what we need to avoid is to set up systems that finally becomes futile because of the manner in which we have actually put things in place. And then we appreciate the fact that you're saying that you're developing a defaulter strategy, because for years we've been talking about this. Even this port of entry thing, nobody seems to be entertaining it. Other countries like Canada, if you are defaulting on maintenance, you'll never fly out of Canada to another country. When you produce your passport, then they know that it's you and you have not paid. They say, wait a minute, and the police come. And you'll have to first go and settle your to be sure that wherever you're going, your children or your family will actually survive, as you're busy working and you're going all over the world and being seen as somebody respectable. Be seen as respectable after you've actually attended to your family needs. Honorable Mutapo, and then Honorable Mbumlana.
Thank you,
sir. There are a lot of questions that haven't been answered yet.
Can I also give you an opportunity?
No, I just want the questions,
Yes.
Because we're running out of time, I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you suggest we do with the questions that you're worried about, Honorable Swart?
Well, it depends, are we going to sit beyond 1 o'clock? Because the one question I asked about the international treaties is critical. I do need an answer on that.
Okay.
But feel free to ask follow-up. If not for me, it's in your hands, Chair. But that's the one question I would like to answer.
Okay, let's do the follow-up questions. They have noted your concern.
Okay.
You should indicate what we should do with the Honorable
okay.
Swart's concern.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Malema, what is happening to integration of Child Protection Register and Sexual Offences Register to avoid duplication of calls? Remember, we alluded to this issue previously, but it appears now it is gradually vanishing. Thank you.
I understand the department did give some reply. I'm worried about the rate of transformation in the department. I'm worried because the law was actually used as a weapon of oppressing people in the past. It has got that stigma. It's very, very important for people to have a trust in it. Secondly, I think that the question of language used in courts should be taken seriously, because it means justice. The emphasis seems to be on the recording more than on the justice. I made this example and said one time, the whole system depends on what the police wrote as a statement.
the policeman may not know English. He may write what he thinks the complainant is saying, or what he thinks the accused is saying. And the whole system goes up based on that. But if it was written in his own language, understanding people, you know, right through, and even in court, that thing is being said. And I said that then justice will be done. But it is for the department to decide how it should put on record. So in other words, the record should not be more important than the actual procedures, because the real justice is on the procedure, on getting the facts and so on. So I wish people could understand that. And I think they are doing it very well in the Western Cape, because they just go do it in Afrikaans. Everybody understands and everybody is going, and even record it to an Afrikaans. But it doesn't work with African languages. And I think that it is unfair. And when you say it is difficult for people or prosecutors or magistrates, I don't think justice is for them. I think justice is for the accused and the community. And the victims, more than for the officers of court, who must learn the African languages and understand. And if they have not done that, there used to be a time when if you have not done Latin, you would not pass law, or if you have not done Afrikaans, you would not pass law. I don't know why is it that it can't be the same thing with the African languages. I don't understand. I think that it's time now we don't become second-class citizens in our own country. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, the comments and the guidance of the committee in respect of the issues that you've raised are noted, and we will take them into the policy terrain as we traverse. In respect of the integration of the two registers, I would request that we give you a written feedback, because the last time I dealt with this was when I was acting last time, so I'd need to get an update as to, you know, I know that there was a committee that was set up between ourselves, justice and social development, but also with the police. There were issues around the location of the registrars. The registrar was going to be divided into, you know, part A and part B, but I'd prefer that Chairperson would get the director leading the process to actually give us the latest in terms of, you know, where this process is of the integration. Thank you, and we will consider, you know, things like the LLB, you know, the curriculum and the inclusion of ethnic languages, so that we make the law accessible. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I don't know whether you've answered Honorable Swart.
Thank you. Before I commence with the answer, maybe I should give a little background on international agreements, because they're not like your standard kind of contracts. They're agreements between state and state, or state and an international organization such as the United Nations, the African Union and others. Meaning that in our own country, it will be the government of the Republic of South Africa and another country as parties. But in between that agreement, you'll have an article dealing with the competent authority. The competent authority will be a specific department that is responsible for such matters, with a mutual legal assistance and extradition treaties. Those will be managed by the Department of Justice. Just to answer that first question on the anchoring, all international agreements are stored in the Department of DERCO, which is International Relations. They have a section called the Treaty Section. So all agreements which are entered into between South Africa and all other countries are stored there, be they Department of Justice related agreements or health-related agreements or education. So the repository of our international agreements is DERCO, not the Department of Justice. But the Department of Justice is, however, responsible for justice-related agreements. So now going back to agreements as such, we have our enabling legislation, which is our international agreement, Section 231 of the Constitution, deals with international agreements. So in terms of Section 231 of the Constitution, you'll have multilateral agreements or agreements with serious financial impact, political impact, major agreements. Those are generally your multilateral agreements between many countries and South Africa. You will also have your bilateral agreements between South Africa and another country. But depending on the impact of the agreement to the country, it can be classified as a Section 2312 agreement or a Section 2313 agreement. So Section 231 agreements will never enter into force in our own country before they before we are given a resolution by the National Council of Provinces and the National Assembly to say go and deposit an instrument of ratification. And unfortunately for us, the extradition agreements as well as the mutual legal assistance agreements are also, they also fall within the category of Section 2312 agreements. So in terms of the enabling statutes, which is the Extradition Act, Act No. 67 of 1962, as well as the International Cooperation in Criminal Matters Act, 75 of 1996, those agreements will never enter, will never be entered into, and they will never enter into force for us as a country unless we get an approval from the National Council of Provinces and the National Assembly to say go and deposit the instrument of ratification. So the moment we get that resolution, it means then in a certain way that enables almost everybody in South Africa to know that we are entering into this particular kind of agreement. But then you also have your Section 2313 agreement, which are departmental specific in general. Some of them are not of major political or other significance. They have no financial consequences for the country, and they do not even affect the domestic law. So those are routine agreements which can be entered into by the government of the Republic of South Africa and another country. But those agreements, that is your Section 2313, must be tabled before Parliament within a reasonable time. And that enables now the country to be aware of the fact that we have entered into this particular kind of agreement. On the specific question of the country that you mentioned, I think my colleague will add to that because now she is the one responsible for the justice-related matters. I'm from the Office of the Chief Legal Advisor, I'm the acting chief, so we actually go through all agreements. We scrutinize all international agreements for consistency with the domestic law and the format, language and style. But the justice-related matters will be handled by Kali Pile. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to correct, I'm not responsible for that area that deals with international treaties, but I can talk to the issues because I'll stand in for my colleague today. With regard to the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, as Susan has pointed out, our department is responsible for those treaties in terms of the International Cooperation in Criminal Matters Act, and that's the act that empowers us to do Mutual Legal Assistance Treaties. I understand from the official that actually works with these matters that the treaty with Egypt is operational. It has been signed, so that is currently in operation. The one with the UAE is awaiting their acceptance of the exclusion of torture, cruelty, and inhumane treatment in the treaty. I think we are all aware of the Constitutional Court case relating to the Botswana citizen, where we are to, I think it related to the extradition of that individual. Botswana wanted his extradition, and he was going to face the death penalty in Botswana. And the Constitutional Court ruled that we cannot extradite him until we get an assurance that he will not be sentenced, where the death penalty will not be given effect to. And I think it's the same situation. We are waiting that assurance from the UAE before that kind of agreement can be concluded.
Sorry, how long do you wait? Because my concern is the one agreement has been entered into, the tax agreement. That is a very irregular agreement, and you can't comment on that because it's not your domain. Tax specialists, even government people, said it's a strange agreement that only benefits the one country. Here you've got extradition treatment that has been, according to your document, discussed in January and March, and no further advances made with that. So, it could be seen to benefit residents of that country. It could be seen to benefit certain people that could be leaving this country to evade prosecution. That is my concern. You probably can't take it any further because that is my political opinion, Chair, but it is a matter that we need to raise. Why is the one treaty signed? And I'll have to do more research in terms of what you say as to whether why the tax treaty is signed and why the other not. Because normally they would all be signed together. And so, Chair, I think I've probably got enough information for us to just look into it further. Because I'm going to ask the NPA when they appear, what steps have you got in place in case people that are suspects in terms of state capture leave the country and you've got an extradition treaty? But there's a beneficial tax treaty, which means our tax authority cannot claim for tax now. That is a significant problem. So, Chair, I'll leave it with you, and I can't expect you to take it further, but I would like you to try and follow up as to what is the delay, obviously, and then I'd like to find out, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Sir. I think what it actually means is that we just need to remind you to follow on processes, because you've indicated that in terms of Section 2312 treaties, then they've got to be tabled with National Assembly and National Council of Provinces, and even with the ones that you regard as routine treaties, they still need to be tabled. So what we need to actually just say today is that please follow process. When it's time for you to table the treaty in Parliament, do so that it doesn't come out like it's coming out now through Honourable Swart, that there's a treaty of concern that the committee is not aware of. Thanks. Are you responding?
Just a bit.
The mic's not working.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just wanted to add something. Because now, generally, when you negotiate for international agreements, our Bible is the Constitution, and our Bible is also supported by the Constitutional Court decisions, such as Yuan Makwanyan and others, where we're negotiating with a country that has the death penalty. We struggle to finalize such kind of agreements, because now we'll need some assurances and other things from that country to say, if we extradite one of our own, will you at least favor him or her by not imposing the death penalty, or if you impose it, you don't execute it. That's generally what's happening.
Not going to detain. The question was around implementation and development of these policies. Because when you look at all the international human rights treaties, there are human rights there about access to justice. And if justice actually distances itself from all these human rights treaties, then it becomes problematic. That's the matter that we'll need to follow on in future. Thank you very much. I think this then brings us to the end of the business. Do you still want to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there was just a response to two or three questions. Now, the first one was the question from the Honourable Member on the learnerships and the internships and the opportunities, if there are any opportunities created within the department. Maybe just, although we've reported that as at the end of the 31st of March 2017, we had, I think it was 852 compared to our target of 850. Actually, in the first quarter of this financial year, our numbers stood at 1,322. And the reason for that being is we have various types of learnerships and internships. A TVET learner, for example, requires 18 months, so it stretches over more than one financial period, where those who have already qualified and graduated for the work-based experience, they then have 12 months. We had gone through a process of determining which posts are critical, given the compensation of employees challenges that we had in terms of the budget. For the post where we are allowed to advertise only internally, we had then given the interns and the learners also an opportunity to apply. So when I say internally, it was only internally in the department itself, so they don't even have to compete with other colleagues in the general public service as a whole, and the prescripts make provision for that. And those posts would have been advertised in August of this year. We are hoping that the processes would be finalized, and when I say processes finalized, that the appointment memos are actually signed by the end of this week, and those colleagues could then start. With regards to, just to add on to the acting DG's comment on the information regulator, I think it was Honourable Warren that had asked a question in terms of capacity in the information regulator. The information regulator and advocate Lakula had engaged the department to ask if there are possibilities for secondments to the information regulator as part of the setup phase. The department and the information regulator, through the engagement with individuals, had identified four individuals in the department. One of the individuals is at chief director level. That the person has been identified to be the acting CEO of the information regulator to take control of the administration and then put processes in place to ensure that the setup then happens smoothly going forward. And then there was also some legal capacity that they had identified for possible appointment and then administrative staff to also run with the administration in terms of the committees that needs to be set up. In terms of, there was a question on employees doing business with the organs of state. I think it was Honourable Swart and Honourable Horn that had asked the question. In terms of the vetting, the outcome of the vetting could be at various levels. For secret and top secret, the clearance is for 5 years specifically. For confidential, it can go as far as 10 years. Some of the matters that are assessed during the vetting process for employees includes the declaration of directorship and obviously also the sponsorships and those type of things that are obtained. Our integrity management unit, there's also the process in terms of the public service prescripts that makes provision for an employee putting in and submitting an application for remunerative work outside of the public service. Our integrity management has been directed, the ethics officers, that as part of that process, they also need to have a look at whether that specific employee has submitted an application, has either previously done business with organs of state, or is currently doing business with organs of state, because that also needs to be taken into consideration when a decision is made on the remunerative work outside of the public service specifically. In terms of service providers that are vetted, there is a screening process that is done as part of the bid process before the bid is awarded, and that screening process, I am advised, is valid for the period of the bid. So as soon when there's a new bid that goes out, the same screening process also gets conducted, and that also takes into account the verification on the status of the directors of that company as it is declared. I think those are the three, I think, big ticket items that I just wanted to respond to, Honourable Chair.
Okay, I think we are
out
of time. It actually brings us to the end of this business. And thank you all for having managed to come and present before us. There is an announcement for lunch. Just outside, there's lunch for all of us.
Thank you. Within the next 2 weeks, we need to have the written answers.
Okay, yeah.